Chapter 16. Prove Yourself. Most people want to be seduced. If they resist your efforts, it's probably because you haven't gone far enough to allay their doubts about your motives, the depth of your feelings, and so on. One well-timed action that shows how far you are willing to go to win them over will dispel their doubts. Don't worry about looking foolish or making a mistake. Any kind of deed that is self-sacrificing and for your target's sake will so overwhelm their emotions they won't notice anything else. Never appear discouraged by people's resistance or complain. Instead, meet the challenge by doing something extreme or chivalrous. Conversely, spur others to prove themselves by making yourself hard to reach, unattainable, worth fighting over. Seductive evidence. Anyone can talk big, say lofty things about their feelings, insist on how much they care for us and also for all oppressed peoples in the far reaches of the planet. But if they never behave in a way that will back up their words, we begin to doubt their sincerity. Perhaps we're dealing with a charlatan or a hypocrite or a coward. Flattery and fine words can only go so far. A time will eventually arrive when you will have to show your victim some evidence to match your words with deeds. This kind of evidence has two functions. First, it allays any lingering doubts about you. Second, an action that reveals some positive quality in you is immensely seductive in and of itself. Brave or selfless deeds create a powerful and positive emotional reaction. Don't worry, your deeds don't have to be so brave and selfless that you lose everything in the process. The appearance alone of nobility will often suffice. In fact, in a world where people overanalyze and talk too much, any kind of action has a bracing, seductive effect. It's normal in the course of a seduction to encounter resistance. The more obstacles you overcome, of course, the greater the pleasure that awaits you. But many a seduction fails because the seducer doesn't correctly read the resistances of the target. More often than not, you give up too easily. First, understand a primary law of seduction. Resistance is a sign that the other person's emotions are engaged in the process. The only person you cannot seduce is somebody distant and cold. Resistance is emotional and can be transformed into its opposite, much as in jiu-jitsu, the physical resistance of an opponent can be used to make him fall. If people resist you because they don't trust you, an apparently selfless deed showing how far you're willing to go to prove yourself is a powerful remedy. If they resist because they are virtuous or because they are loyal to someone else, all the better. Virtue and repressed desire are easily overcome by action. As the great seductress Natalie Barney once wrote, "Most virtue is a demand for greater seduction." There are two ways to prove yourself. First, the spontaneous action. A situation arises in which the target needs help, a problem needs solving, or simply he or she needs a favor. You cannot foresee these situations, but you must be ready for them, for they can spring up at any time. Impress the target by going further than really necessary, sacrificing more money, more time, more effort than they had expected. Your target will often use these moments or even manufacture them as a kind of test. Will you retreat? Or will you rise to the occasion? You cannot hesitate or flinch, even for a moment, or all is lost. If necessary, make the deed seem to have cost you more than it has, never with words, but indirectly. Exhausted looks, reports spread through a third party, whatever it takes. The second way to prove yourself is the brave deed that you plan and execute in advance, on your own and at the right moment, preferably some way into the seduction, when any doubts the victim still has about you are more dangerous than earlier on. Choose a dramatic, difficult action that reveals the painful time and effort involved. Danger can be extremely seductive. Cleverly lead your victim into a crisis, a moment of danger, or indirectly put them in an uncomfortable position, and you can play the rescuer, the gallant knight. The powerful feelings and emotions this elicits can easily be redirected into love. Some examples. Number 1. In France, in the 1640s, Marion de Lorme was the courtesan men lusted after the most. Renowned for her beauty, she had been the mistress of Cardinal Richelieu, among other notable political and military figures. To win her bed was a sign of achievement. For weeks, the rake, Count Grammont, had wooed de Lorme, and finally she had given him an appointment for a particular evening. The Count prepared himself for a delightful encounter, but on the day of the appointment, he received a letter from her, in which she explained in polite and tender terms her terrible regrets. She had the most awful headache and would have to stay in bed that evening. Their appointment would have to be postponed. The Count felt certain he was being pushed to the side for someone else, for de Lorme was as capricious as she was beautiful. Grammont did not hesitate. At nightfall, he rode to the Marais, where de Lorme lived, and scouted the area. In a square near her home, he spotted a man approaching on foot. Recognizing the Duc de Brissac, he immediately knew that this man was to supplant him in the courtesan's bed. Brissac seemed unhappy to see the Count, and so Grammont approached him hurriedly and said, "Brissac, my friend, you must do me a service of the greatest importance. I have an appointment, for the first time, with a girl who lives near this place, and as this visit is only to concert measures, I shall make but a very short stay. Be so kind as to lend me your cloak and walk my horse a little until I return, but above all, do not go far from this place." Without waiting for an answer, Grammont took the Duke's cloak and handed him the bridle of his horse. Looking back, he saw that Brissac was watching him, so he pretended to enter a house, slipped out through the back, circled around, and reached de Lorme's house without being seen. Grammont knocked at the door, and a servant, mistaking him for the Duke, let him in. He headed straight for the lady's chamber, where he found her lying on a couch in a sheer gown. He threw off Brissac's cloak, and she gasped in fright. "What's the matter, my fair one?" he asked. "Your headache, to all appearance, is gone?" She seemed put out, exclaimed she still had the headache, and insisted that he leave. It was up to her, she said, to make or break appointments. "Madam," Grammont said calmly, "I know what perplexes you. You are afraid lest Brissac should meet me here, but you may make yourself easy on that account." He then opened the window and revealed Brissac out in the square, dutifully walking back and forth with a horse like a common stable boy. He looked ridiculous. De Lorme burst out laughing, threw her arms around the Count, and exclaimed, "My dear Chevalier, I can hold out no longer. You are too amiable and too eccentric not to be pardoned." He told her the whole story, and she promised that the Duke could exercise horses all night, but she would not let him in. They made an appointment for the following evening. Outside, the Count returned the cloak, apologized for taking so long, and thanked the Duke. Brissac was most gracious, even holding Grammont's horse for him to mount and waving goodbye as he rode off. Interpretation: Count Grammont knew that most would-be seducers give up too easily, mistaking capriciousness or apparent coldness as a sign of a genuine lack of interest. In fact, it can mean many things. Perhaps the person is testing you, wondering if you're really serious. Prickly behavior is exactly this kind of test. If you give up at the first sign of difficulty, you obviously do not want them that much. Or it could be that they themselves are uncertain about you, or are trying to choose between you and someone else. In any event, it's absurd to give up. One incontrovertible demonstration of how far you're willing to go will overwhelm all doubts. It will also defeat your rivals, since most people are timid, worried about making fools of themselves, and so rarely risk anything. When dealing with difficult or resistant targets, it's usually best to improvise the way Grammont did. If your action seems sudden and a surprise, it will make them more emotional, loosen them up. A little roundabout accumulation of information, a little spying, is always a good idea. Most important is the spirit in which you enact your proof. If you're light-hearted and playful, if you make the target laugh, proving yourself and amusing them at the same time, it won't matter if you mess up or if they see you've employed a little trickery. They will give in to the pleasant mood you've created. Notice that the Count never whined or grew angry or defensive. All he had to do was pull back the curtain and reveal the Duke walking his horse, melting Delorme's resistance with laughter. In one well-executed act, he showed what he would do for a knight of her favors. Number 2. Pauline Bonaparte, the sister of Napoleon, had so many affairs with different men over the years that doctors were afraid for her health. She could not stay with one man for more than a few weeks. Novelty was her only pleasure. After Napoleon married her off to Prince Camillo Borghese in 1803, her affairs only multiplied. And so, when she met the dashing major Jules de Canouville in 1810, everyone assumed the affair would last no longer than the others. Of course, the major was a decorated soldier, well-educated, an accomplished dancer, and one of the most handsome men in the army. But Pauline, 30 years old at the time, had had affairs with dozens of men who could have matched that resume. A few days after the affair began, the imperial dentist arrived chez Pauline. A toothache had been causing her sleepless nights, and the dentist saw he would have to pull out the bad tooth right then and there. No painkillers were used at the time, and as the man began to take out his various instruments, Pauline grew terrified. Despite the pain of the tooth, she changed her mind and refused to have it pulled. Major Canouville was lounging on a couch in a silken robe. Taking all this in, he tried to encourage her to have it done. A moment or two of pain and it's over forever. A child could go through with it and not utter a sound, he said. I'd like to see you do it, she said. Canouville got up, went over to the dentist, chose a tooth in the back of his own mouth, and ordered that it be pulled. A perfectly good tooth was extracted, and Canouville barely batted an eyelash. After this, not only did Pauline let the dentist do his job, her opinion of Canouville changed. No man had ever done anything like this for her before. The affair had been going to last but a few weeks. Now it stretched on. Napoleon was not pleased. Pauline was a married woman. Short affairs were allowed, but a deep attachment was embarrassing. He sent Canouville to Spain to deliver a message to a general there. The mission would take weeks, and in the meantime, Pauline would find someone else. Canouville, though, was not your average lover. Riding day and night, without stopping to eat or sleep, he arrived in Salamanca within a few days. There he found that he could proceed no farther, since communications had been cut off, and so, without waiting for further orders, he rode back to Paris, without an escort, through enemy territory. He could meet with Pauline only briefly. Napoleon sent him right back to Spain. It was months before he was finally allowed to return, but when he did, Pauline immediately resumed her affair with him, an unheard-of act of loyalty on her part. This time, Napoleon sent Canouville to Germany, and finally to Russia, where he died bravely in battle in 1812. He was the only lover Pauline ever waited for, and the only one she ever mourned. Interpretation. In seduction, the time often comes when the target has begun to fall for you, but suddenly pulls back. Your motives have begun to seem dubious. Perhaps all you are after is sexual favors, or power, or money. Most people are insecure, and doubts like these can ruin the seductive illusion. In the case of Pauline Bonaparte, She was quite accustomed to using men for pleasure, and she knew perfectly well that she was being used in turn. She was totally cynical. But people often use cynicism to cover up insecurity. Pauline's secret anxiety was that none of her lovers had ever really loved her, that all of them, to a man, had really just wanted sex or political favors from her. When Canoville showed through concrete actions the sacrifices he would make for her, his tooth, his career, his life, he transformed a deeply selfish woman into a devoted lover. Not that her response was completely unselfish. His deeds were a boost to her vanity. If she could inspire these actions from him, she must be worth it. But if he was going to appeal to the noble side of her nature, she had to rise to that level as well and prove herself by remaining loyal to him. Making your deed as dashing and chivalrous as possible will elevate the seduction to a new level, stir up deep emotions, and conceal any ulterior motives you may have. The sacrifices you're making must be visible. Talking about them or explaining what they've cost you will seem like bragging. Lose sleep, fall ill, lose valuable time, put your career on the line, spend more money than you can afford. You can exaggerate all this for effect, but don't get caught boasting about it or feeling sorry for yourself. Cause yourself pain and let them see it. Since almost everyone else in the world seems to have an angle, your noble and selfless deed will be irresistible. Number 3. Throughout the 1890s and into the early 20th century, Gabriele D'Annunzio was considered one of Italy's premier novelists and playwrights. Yet many Italians could not stand the man. His writing was florid, and in person he seemed full of himself, overdramatic, riding horses naked on the beach, pretending to be a Renaissance man, and more of the kind. His novels were often about war and about the glory of facing and defeating death, an entertaining subject for someone who had never actually done so. And so, at the start of World War I, no one was surprised that D'Annunzio led the call for Italy to side with the Allies and enter the fray. Everywhere you turned, there he was, giving a speech in favor of war, a campaign that succeeded in 1915 when Italy finally declared war on Germany and Austria. D'Annunzio's role so far had been completely predictable, but what did surprise the Italian public was what this 52-year-old man did next. He joined the army. He had never served in the military. Boats made him seasick, but he could not be dissuaded. Eventually, the authorities gave him a post in a cavalry division, hoping to keep him out of combat. Italy had little experience in war, and its military was somewhat chaotic. The generals somehow lost track of D'Annunzio, who in any case had decided to leave his cavalry division and form units of his own. He was an artist, after all, and could not be subjected to army discipline. Calling himself Comandante, he overcame his habitual seasickness and directed a series of daring raids, leading groups of motorboats in the middle of the night into Austrian harbors and firing torpedoes at anchored ships. He also learned how to fly and began to lead dangerous sorties. In August of 1915, he flew over the city of Trieste, then in enemy hands, and dropped Italian flags and thousands of pamphlets containing a message of hope, written in his inimitable style. The end of your martyrdom is at hand. The dawn of your joy is imminent. From the heights of heaven on the wings of Italy, I throw you this pledge, this message from my heart. He flew at altitudes unheard of at the time and through thick enemy fire. The Austrians put a price on his head. On a mission in 1916, D'Annunzio fell against his machine gun, permanently injuring one eye and seriously damaging the other. Told his flying days were over, he convalesced in his home in Venice. At the time, the most beautiful and fashionable woman in Italy was generally considered to be the Countess Morosini, former mistress of the German Kaiser. Her palace was on the Grand Canal, opposite the home of D'Annunzio. Now she found herself besieged by letters and poems from the writer-soldier, mixing details of his flying exploits with declarations of his love. In the middle of air raids on Venice, he would cross the canal, barely able to see out of one eye, to deliver his latest poem. D'Annunzio was much beneath Morosini's station, a mere writer, but his willingness to brave anything on her behalf won her over. The fact that his reckless behavior could get him killed any day only hastened the seduction. D'Annunzio ignored the doctor's advice and returned to flying, leading even more daring raids than before. By the end of the war, he was Italy's most decorated hero. Now, wherever in the nation he appeared, the public filled the piazzas to hear his speeches. After the war, he led a march on Fiume, on the Adriatic coast. In the negotiations to settle the war, Italians believed they should have been awarded this city. But the Allies had not agreed. D'Annunzio's forces took over the city, and the poet became a leader, ruling Fiume for more than a year as an autonomous republic. By then, everyone had forgotten about his less than glorious past as a decadent writer. Now, he could do no wrong. Interpretation. The appeal of seduction is that of being separated from our normal routines, experiencing the thrill of the unknown. Death is the ultimate unknown. In periods of chaos, confusion, and death, the plagues that swept Europe in the Middle Ages, the terror of the French Revolution, the air raids on London during World War II, people often let go of their usual caution and do things they never would otherwise. They experience a kind of delirium. There is something immensely seductive about danger, about heading into the unknown. Show that you have a reckless streak and a daring nature, that you lack the usual fear of death, and you are instantly fascinating to the bulk of humanity. What you are proving in this instance is not how you feel toward another person, but something about yourself. You are willing to go out on a limb. You're not just another talker and braggart. It's a recipe for instant charisma. Any political figure, Churchill, De Gaulle, Kennedy, who has proven himself on the battlefield, has an unmatchable appeal. Many had thought of D'Annunzio as a foppish womanizer. His experience in the war gave him a heroic sheen, a Napoleonic aura. In fact, he had always been an effective seducer, but now he was even more devilishly appealing. You do not necessarily have to risk death, but putting yourself in its vicinity will give you a seductive charge. It's often best to do this some way into the seduction, making it come as a pleasant surprise. You are willing to enter the unknown. No one is more seductive than the person who has had a brush with death. People will be drawn to you. Perhaps they're hoping that some of your adventurous spirit will rub off on them. Number 4. According to one version of the Arthurian legend, the great knight, Sir Lancelot, once caught a glimpse of Queen Guinevere, King Arthur's wife, and that glimpse was enough. He fell madly in love. And so when word reached him that Queen Guinevere had been kidnapped by an evil knight, Lancelot did not hesitate. He forgot his other chivalrous tasks and hurried in pursuit. His horse collapsed from the chase, so he continued on foot. Finally, it seemed that he was close, but he was exhausted and could go no farther. A horse-driven cart passed by. The cart was filled with loathsome-looking men shackled together. In those days, it was the tradition to place criminals, murderers, traitors, cowards, thieves, in such a cart, which then passed through every street in town so that people could see it. Once you had ridden in the cart, you lost all feudal rights for the rest of your life. The cart was such a dreadful symbol that seeing an empty one made you shiver and give the sign of the cross. Even so, Sir Lancelot accosted the cart's driver, a dwarf. "In the name of God, tell me if you've seen my lady, the queen, pass by this way." he said. "If you want to get into this cart I'm driving," said the dwarf, "by tomorrow you'll know what has become of the queen." Then he drove the cart onward. Lancelot hesitated for but two of the horse's steps, then ran after it and climbed in. Wherever the cart went, townspeople heckled it. They were most curious about the knight among the passengers. What was his crime? How will he be put to death? Flayed? Drowned? Burned upon a fire of thorns? Finally, the dwarf let him get out without a word as to the whereabouts of the queen. To make matters worse, no one now would go near or talk to Lancelot, for he had been in the cart. He kept on chasing the queen, and all along the way he was cursed at, spat upon, challenged by other knights. He had disgraced knighthood by riding in the cart. But no one could stop him or slow him down, and finally he discovered that the queen's kidnapper was the wicked Meleagant. He caught up with Meleagant, and the two fought a duel. Still weak from the chase, Lancelot seemed to be near defeat, but when word reached him that the queen was watching the battle, he recovered his strength and was on the verge of killing Meleagant when a truce was called. Guinevere was handed over to him. Lancelot could hardly contain his joy at the thought of finally being in his lady's presence, but to his shock, she seemed angry and would not look at her rescuer. She told Meleagant's father, "Sire, in truth he has wasted his efforts. I shall always deny that I feel any gratitude toward him." Lancelot was mortified, but he did not complain. Much later, after undergoing innumerable further trials, she finally relented, and they became lovers. One day he asked her, when she had been abducted by Meleagant, had she heard the story of the cart and how he had disgraced knighthood? Was that why she had treated him so coldly that day? The queen replied, "By delaying for two steps, you showed your unwillingness to climb into it. That, to tell the truth, is why I didn't wish to see you or speak with you." Interpretation. The opportunity to do your selfless deed often comes upon you suddenly. You have to show your worth in an instant, right there on the spot. It could be a rescue situation, a gift you could make, or a favor you could do, a sudden request to drop everything and come to their aid. What matters most is not whether you act rashly, make a mistake, and do something foolish, but that you seem to act on their behalf without thought for yourself or the consequences. At moments like these, hesitation, even for a few seconds, can ruin all the hard work of your seduction, revealing you as self-absorbed, unchivalrous, and cowardly. This, at any rate, is the moral of Chrétien de Troyes' 12th century version of the story of Lancelot. Remember, not only what you do matters, but how you do it. If you are naturally self-absorbed, learn to disguise it. React as spontaneously as possible, exaggerating the effect by seeming flustered, overexcited, even foolish. Love has driven you to that point. If you have to jump into the cart for Guinevere's sake, make sure she sees that you do it without the slightest hesitation. Number 5. In Rome, sometime around 1531, word spread of a sensational young woman named Tullia d'Aragona. By the standards of the period, Tullia was not a classic beauty. She was tall and thin, at a time when the plump and voluptuous woman was considered the ideal. And she lacked the cloying, giggling manner of most young girls who wanted masculine attention. No, her quality was nobler. Her Latin was perfect. She could discuss the latest literature. She played the lute and sang. In other words, she was a novelty. And since that was all most men were looking for, they began to visit her in great numbers. She had a lover, a diplomat, and the thought that one man had won her physical favors drove them all mad. Her male visitors began to compete for her attention, writing poems in her honor, vying to become her favorite, None of them succeeded, but they kept on trying. Of course, there were some who were offended by her, stating publicly that she was no more than a high-class whore. They repeated the rumor, perhaps true, that she had made older men dance while she played the lute, and if their dancing pleased her, they could hold her in their arms. To Tullia's faithful followers, all of noble birth, this was slander. They wrote a document that was distributed far and wide. It said, "Our honored mistress, the well-born and honorable Lady Tullia d'Aragona, doth surpass all ladies of the past, present, or future by her dazzling qualities. Anyone who refuses to conform to this statement is hereby charged to enter the lists with one of the undersigned knights, who will convince him in the customary manner." Tullia left Rome in 1535, going first to Venice, where the poet Tasso became her lover, and eventually to Ferrara, which was then perhaps the most civilized court in Italy. And what a sensation she caused there! Her voice, her singing, even her poems were praised far and wide. She opened a literary academy devoted to ideas of free thinking. She called herself a muse, and, as in Rome, a group of young men collected around her. They would follow her around the city, carving her name in trees, writing sonnets in her honor, and singing them to anyone who would listen. One young nobleman was driven to distraction by this cult of adoration. It seemed that everyone loved Tullia, but no one received her love in return. Determined to steal her away and marry her, this young man tricked her into allowing him to visit her at night. He proclaimed his undying devotion, showered her with jewels and presents, and asked for her hand. She refused. He pulled out a knife. She still refused, and so he stabbed himself. He lived, but now Tullia's reputation was even greater than before. Not even money could buy her favors, or so it seemed. As the years went by and her beauty faded, some poet or intellectual would always come to her defense and protect her. Few of them ever pondered the reality that Tullia was indeed a courtesan, one of the most popular and well-paid in the profession. Interpretation. All of us have defects of some sort. Some of these we're born with and cannot help. Tullia had many such defects. Physically, she was not the Renaissance ideal. Also, her mother had been a courtesan, and she was illegitimate. Yet the men who fell under her spell didn't care. They were too distracted by her image. The image of an elevated woman, a woman you would have to fight over to win. Her pose came straight out of the Middle Ages, the days of knights and troubadours. Then, a woman, most often married, was able to control the power dynamic between the sexes by withholding her favors until the knight somehow proved his worth and the sincerity of his sentiments. He could be sent on a quest, or made to live among lepers, or compete in a possibly fatal joust for her honor. And this he had to do without complaint. Although the days of the troubadour are long gone, the pattern remains. A man actually loves to be able to prove himself, to be challenged, to compete, to undergo tests and trials and emerge victorious. He has a masochistic streak. A part of him loves pain. And strangely enough, the more a woman asks for, the worthier she seems. A woman who is easy to get cannot be worth much. Make people compete for your attention. Make them prove themselves in some way, and you will find them rising to the challenge. The heat of seduction is raised by such challenges. Show me that you really love me. When one person of either sex rises to the occasion, often the other person is now expected to do the same, and the seduction heightens. By making people prove themselves, too, you raise your value and cover up your defects. Your targets are too busy trying to prove themselves to notice your blemishes and faults. Reversal. When trying to prove that you are worthy of your target, remember that every target sees things differently. A show of physical prowess will not impress someone who doesn't value physical prowess. It will just show that you're after attention, flaunting yourself. Seducers must adapt their way of proving themselves to the doubts and weaknesses of the seduced. For some, fine words are better proofs than daredevil deeds, particularly if they are written down. With these people, show your sentiments in a letter, a different kind of physical proof, and one with more poetic appeal than some showy bit of action. Know your target well and aim your seductive evidence at the source of their doubts or resistance.